Welcome back to the Expert Witness Playbook, the podcast where we sit down with the people behind the cases. I'm Dr. Brian Woodruff, a board-certified pediatric neurologist and expert witness. On this show, we talk with physicians, attorneys, and the professionals who support expert work every day, diving into how cases are built, how opinions are formed, and what actually happens behind the scenes. Today's guest is Dr. John Lundell, an accomplished anesthesiologist, author, and expert witness. Dr. Lundell's career has spanned military and civilian practice, including leadership roles at teaching hospitals, deployment in support of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and extensive experience mentoring trainees and fellow physicians. He has published educational materials for medical students and perioperative nurses, and is recognized for his contributions to physician coaching and expert witness testimony across more than 20 states. Dr. Lundell is also dedicated to creative solutions for workplace burnout and job sharing, and brings a wealth of real-world insight to the field. Whether you're an expert witness thinking about becoming one, or you work with experts regularly, this podcast is designed to give you practical insights you can actually use. Let's get into the playbook. Welcome, John. It's great to have you on the podcast today. I've been excited about getting a chance to talk with you further because you've kind of done it all. You're a doctor, you're an expert, and you're an expert's expert. So let's dive right in. Tell us a little bit, you know, a lot of people that listen to this are physicians and are thinking about getting into expert witness work. But I think it would be helpful to hear a little bit about your clinical practice.
Sure. So I've been in practice for, 28 years. And first in the Air Force, paying back for the scholarship they gave me to go to school, medical school.
And then, that was generous. Yeah.
Then since I did a fellowship before going to the military, and my wife, who's a radiologist, wanted to do a fellowship, but her residency was 5 years. Mine was four. So I did residency, fellowship, Air Force. She did residency, Air Force. And when she got out, she said, hey, I want to go do a fellowship. So we went to UCSD for a year. And I was on the faculty there, and she was a fellow in the radiology department. We decided California was too expensive to stay there. And we came back to Texas, found a job here in the Dallas area, and I've been with the same group ever since 2005.
Did you grow up in Texas?
No, actually, I grew up in San Jose, which is Silicon
Valley. That's right.
California.
That's right. Yeah.
But yeah, we've been here in Texas for quite a while. We were in San Antonio with the Air Force before we went off to UCSD, and then came back here to Dallas for the employment opportunities.
Yeah.
And my group has been really, really kind of nice. We are the main group, well, the only group now, covering Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas. So even though there aren't anesthesia residents there, there's all kinds of other residents. And sometimes we get rotators from anesthesia or medical students or nurse anesthetist trainees. So there have been great opportunities to teach, which I really like doing. And then we also and we had opportunities to supervise nurse anesthetists in the care team model with an anesthesiologist and three or four nurse anesthetists. And we've had the opportunity to do our own cases individually, sit in the room, you know, don't have anybody else you got to worry about except your one patient at a time. I got to do cardiac for a while, which is what I did my fellowship in. Liked it a lot. Eventually said, you know what, I'm done. It's a long story, but it was a good decision. And I've enjoyed very much practicing anesthesia.
So you've had a long career in anesthesia. What got you into the expert work? How long have you been doing that? And tell us sort of what got into it.
When I was 50 years old, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. And I remember sitting in the neurologist's office and it hitting me like a ton of bricks. 'Cause I kind of knew what I was in for, and it was scary. Fortunately, my wife was sitting next to me and she grabbed my hand and said, "I'm going to be with you every step of the way." And if it weren't
Wow.
for that, I don't know how I would have managed. 'Cause I kind of went, I don't know. At first, diving down the rabbit hole, reading all kinds of stuff on the internet. What's this? What happened? Eventually, you learn it's different for everybody. Progresses
Yeah.
differently. They have different symptoms. There's a whole bunch of symptoms in common. But, and my neurologist assured me that I could practice anesthesia safely for many years to come. Certainly 5 or 6, maybe 10 or more. But I still kind of had that in the back of my mind. I didn't really tell too many people about it. And so when it was time to, let's see, I got something in the mail that was from Seek, where they offer, what do they call it? It was every October in Chicago, they do a course. Well, not a course, more like a big seminar. All kinds of speakers and all kinds of alumni who come and talk about what other opportunities there are outside of clinical medicine.
Oh yeah,
And
they're non, I haven't been to it. They're non-clinical careers for physicians. They have a conference.
exactly.
Yes. Where they
That's what
have
they call it.
authors and people from industry. I have seen that brochure.
Yeah. I went there. All kinds of people there were miserable in clinical medicine. I
Yes.
wasn't, but I was afraid I wouldn't be able to stick with it for all that long. But as I said, my neurologist reassured me, and as the years progressed, I started to believe what they told me. But I was kind of primed. That seemed like a gift from heaven, that letter. So that I went to that conference. At that time, my mother was in the hospital having just had surgery. She ultimately ended up dying a few weeks later, excuse me, because of some alleged malpractice. And my siblings sued. My dad passed a few months after that. And
Oh,
then a couple months later, I got a call out of the blue from a, or a, maybe it was a message, but from LinkedIn. I had nothing written on there saying I would be an expert witness or had been or wanted to be, but I had a lawyer call me saying, "I need an expert witness. I want somebody local. It's here in Dallas. It's for the defense. Would you be interested?" So I was kind of primed to say, yeah, I'd be interested in doing it. But I didn't know anything about how to do it. So I started to
exactly.
say, all right, I'll do it. And I started to figure out how can I learn what I need to know to do this. And I couldn't get off to go to any of the conferences. So I ordered some DVDs off the internet from Seek. And it was intimidating. There was a lot of stuff you have to know, and the law seems just kind of complicated. But I went through that, and it took months and months for the attorney to get back to me and say, "Okay, we're moving forward with this." And eventually, I learned that the wheels of the legal system turn very slowly most of the time.
That's one thing that people that we've talked about is these cases can have a couple years of what's happening and things and pauses and if you get a case, you need to be available for the next 2 to 3 years.
Yeah, and sometimes much longer. I've had a couple cases go 6 years or something.
I had one,
So,
I think was a record. It went 11.
oof,
Yeah,
yeah.
it was just in and out. I think there were appeals. I don't even understand all the legal side of it, but it went on for over 10 years.
Wow,
Yeah.
yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah,
Well,
that's a very unusual case,
yeah,
but
yeah.
I'd say most of them, especially and on the plaintiff's side, you're in it a lot earlier. Sometimes on the defense side, it's quick. You know, you get in, you're moving along. They need a report within a month or two. Then you get deposed and then trials. So on the defense side, sometimes it can be wrapped up in 3 to 6 months. I've had cases you get in and so you had that first case. You decided, yep, hey, I don't know what I'm doing, which is a great, it's great to recognize that. I think there are some people out there that just sort of jump in and don't have a clue, and I don't know how they do it. You know what I mean? Without having a clue of what they're doing. And so you kind of got up to speed in understanding how a case works and the cadence and everything.
You know, and despite going through training and learning what to do and what not to do, I still made mistakes. But I don't think they were as frequent or as big as they would have been if I hadn't had somebody kind of tell me, hey, watch for this, do this, don't do that, and prepare yourself. So, plus, I was a lot less nervous at the deposition, having kind of learned what kind of questions the lawyers are likely to throw my direction and how to respond to them so that you don't get contradicting your words or painted into a corner or anything like that.
What did you do? A lot of people are just getting started in this and they want to hear, what do you think, in somebody that's starting out, what do you think the best way for them to build their practice? Because we talk about it can take a long time. It can take a long time to even get the first case or the first couple cases. What do you see? Because lots of people have different opinions as to what people should do to get their name out there so that people know that they're available.
Yeah, some people don't think you should advertise at all. I think that's kind of crazy. You're a business, you're offering a service. How else are your clients going to find out about you? You can slowly build and let word of mouth spread everything, and some people do that. You can join a bunch of lists, a bunch of directories where you're listed along with other experts, and you kind of wait for the attorneys to find you. Some people think you should go off and give a talk about your clinical specialty and maybe some of the problems that happen with it at a place where attorneys are going to be listening, whether it's a litigators conference or some of the local firms that are involved. I thought at 50 years old and in, I was going to say full practice, but during those years, it almost ended up being more than full-time practice. I'll talk about that more in a second. But in full-time practice and at 50 years old thinking, I don't have that many years left to practice anesthesia and get this expert witness stuff going. So I asked Jim Mangraviti, who's one of the instructors at SEEK, what should I do to ramp up quickly? And he said, you know what? You should get a top-listed ad with SEEK. So what it is it's the very first ad that comes up every time you search. Normally, I listed for a year in the regular directory. So what I got was a tiny little, you know, 4 or 5 sentences, whatever it is, listing in the state of Texas under anesthesiology. When I bought the top listed ad, it eventually ended up costing 10 times more than the basic listing, but it paid for itself every single year that I had that ad. And the ad showed up every time you search for anesthesiologists, every single state, and it appeared right up at the top. So I got a lot of FaceTime, shall we say, with attorneys looking for medical experts. And I got—
Did you get asked about that at deposition? Did you get asked about your directory listings at deposition?
I got asked what I advertised. Yeah. You know, how did you advertise? And I told them, you know, I tried a Google search engine optimization. I tried a couple things, and most of them didn't work very well. But yeah, the ads from SEEK were very good.
And your advice to people if they do it is just to be direct and honest, and if you don't seem like you're hiding anything, there's, you know, it sounds like from your standpoint, there's nothing really to be worried about.
Exactly. That's the most important thing. If you look ashamed, then the audience, the jury, or you know, is going to think, oh, they did something wrong. But if you just say, yeah, I advertise. Here's where I advertise. No big deal. So it's not a problem if you kind of keep it, if you keep your response in that tone.
And you had a website too?
Yeah. Eventually I created a website and then got some help to make it look a little bit not DIY.
Okay. Kind of get it out of the template form. So, so directory there, you know, Seek has a big one. I know that there's a couple others, Juris Pro and ALM. And then there are probably a lot more out there. And then you did a website and, yeah. Did you do any speaking? Like you said, some people speak at conferences. Did you do some speaking or, you know, and how did you get, really. How did you get into that? No,
I did grand rounds at Baylor a couple of times and said, hey, here's some stuff I learned from being an expert witness. And, the anesthesia department loved it. They really liked hearing about, you know, I think I talked about obstructive sleep apnea, some problems with nerve blocks, all kinds of stuff, but it was the kind of thing that I would have. Oh, well, let me think. Wait a minute. I presented to the Perioperative Nurses Association too. So,
okay.
But I didn't present to any lawyers or go to any conferences. So these things were all local right here, you know, on a weekend or on a Tuesday morning or something like that. And didn't take a lot of time away from my clinical practice because this was, let me think. I started 2018 is when I got my first case. And then by the time 2020 hit, we were in COVID and we were doing nothing.
Yeah. Yeah. And things came to a screeching halt.
Once COVID was over, we had a backlog of all kinds of cases. And then for some reason, we had just an even greater stream of cases coming in. So, and we had some colleagues left. For various reasons. And we had a partner die.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. That's a long story too. But there were fewer of us and more work to do. So we were working our butts off and I didn't really
clinically, have time. If you don't have time and if you don't have time, that's another big thing. These cases take a lot of time. Some of them. Especially the cases that I do, there can be thousands of pages in sort of causation and damages in some of these cases. And so they can take tremendous time. And then trying to find times for depositions and trials can be, can certainly be difficult.
Now, I was
if you have a very busy practice.
Oh, I was lucky that I could switch around vacation time when a trial came up or a deposition. I knew I could schedule it on a certain day or something. And I did have to switch things around a few times. But eventually, with our practice becoming, more of our partners were becoming burned out because of working so hard. And several people were interested in slowing down. And we got approval from the group, and several of us joined up as three people sharing two jobs. And so I think there were three of those little groups amongst our larger group of partners. And each of the trios had one person who was kind of in charge of interfacing with the scheduler and figuring out, hey, wait, what are the rules supposed to be in this situation? So ran into a lot of that, and I kind of had to stand up for the trio and still concede appropriate points to the group to make sure that, you know, we're being fair. Once I was in that situation, I had more flexibility with my time and more time off. So it was easier to schedule stuff, which is good because right about that time, I had a lot of people calling me more than I could handle. And so I referred some of them. I had a couple of partners that were, I was kind of mentoring in expert witness work. And I raised my rates too. And let's see what else. A couple of cases I said, yeah, I'm not interested.
No thanks. Yeah. Yeah. I do that. If it's something that just doesn't, I'm to the point where I'm busy enough, it doesn't sound interesting or doesn't seem like, yeah, I'm like, no, you can go find somebody else. And you know, that's just, yeah. Like I don't do any criminal cases.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I don't do any criminal cases. I had one or two a very long time ago, and it's so different. And I think the stakes are so much higher that I just didn't want to be involved in that.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
So are you still doing expert work?
I still have three cases on my docket that haven't finished yet. All my other cases have settled or gone to trial and they're done. So when these three are finished, I'll be finished with being an expert witness. And I'm looking forward to that. I hope it doesn't take too many years, but you know, I'll be retired from anesthesia. And in order to be, some people would say, well, why don't you keep doing expert work? You could do it even though you're not doing anesthesia. In most specialties and most states, you can do some stuff after retirement, but most of the time you have to be practicing at least part-time. Every state is a little different. You have to be 50%, or you have to have been 50% at the time that the incident occurred that led to this lawsuit. Or you have to be, as some states will count time at an academic center as teaching time, as clinical time. Some don't. So it's really, really varied on how much you can do. But basically, when you quit clinical work, you kind of have started the countdown timer towards the end of your expert witness career.
And we've talked about that previously, that this is not something that's standalone. Thing that you can do it, and that's the challenge. It's a big challenge because you have to have you have to be active in clinical, like you said, and then you're trying to navigate the expert work in the midst of that, and that can be really tough, especially for people that do procedures and that have like very set schedules. That doesn't work real well. Let's shift gears a little bit. It sounds like you, obviously a very busy clinical practice, then a very busy expert practice, but then you did something beyond that. You started mentoring some of your partners, which then out of that grew, tell us what grew out of that.
So, when I had cases that I really didn't want to do, or I was too busy to do. And I reached out to a couple of partners that had expressed an interest in expert work. And I said, hey, here's a case for you if you want it. If you have any questions or you need help with anything, call me up. I got on the phone with one of the lawyers when I was referring one of these cases because he kind of wanted me. And I said, well, I really don't want to do it. I got too much going on, but I have this partner. Yeah, it will be his first case, but I'm going to help him if he has any questions. And, I think he accepted that reluctantly. But a lot of other cases, you know, you tell the lawyer, hey, I have a partner who's really good. He's done some expert witness work. And I usually, you know, we bounce ideas off each other or help each other out if we have questions, et cetera, et cetera. And they are so appreciative of having somebody referred to them if you can't do it. And so I remembered to think
absolutely
about who do I know that might be good for this. I had an expert that I became a friend with who's out in Florida, and then I had three partners of mine right here in the Dallas area. So I spread some cases out to them, and they were appreciative, And some of them have gone on to do more stuff. Like one of my partners here decided, hey, that top listed ad kind of thing worked for you. And you say you're about ready to kind of slow down. And can I have that ad? So I told him, yeah, sneak, you want it. And he did. And it was the right timing. And so he got it. And he says, hey, it's already helping me. Every once in a while, he calls me up on the phone and asks me, what do you think? And I, you know, I say, yeah, this, or I agree with you. That's not cool. So, it's been interesting having an opportunity to mentor my partners. And then, I was approached by Amy Fogelman, who's got a, expert witness teaching course online. And she said, hey, I need somebody to help create a course about depositions. She said, I don't, you know, I guess Massachusetts has something where they don't do so many depositions. But she said, you've done more than me. You like to teach. I'd like to partner up. So we figured out how to kind of create a profit sharing and decided what the structure of the course ought to be. And I got busy writing what I thought should be included. And she helped me put it in a format that was similar to her course with recommended reading material after every module. So there's, I think there's 11 or 12 modules. They're each probably about 15 to 20 minutes long. They have
For depositions, John?
This is for depositions.
Okay. And it's still out there and people can find it and they can purchase that
yes, they do.
Independently. And that will march them through like little lectures of 15, 20 minutes each with some reading. Yeah. Okay.
Quiz and, you know, just some stuff to kind of help keep them, a bunch of extra materials that I thought were appropriate to include. I have some videos in there with samples of watching how an expert has done it. And boy, I learned so much in preparing the course. And at the same time, okay, let me back up a little bit. I had been teaching medical students since I left residency and fellowship, off and on, and then teaching nurses off and on. And eventually I wrote a book. Well, I wrote a book for our residents and medical student rotators because in 2 weeks or 4 weeks, they are not going to read a 350-page introduction to anesthesia textbook. It's beyond them. And it's not fair to ask them to do it. So I wrote something that was like a 50-page Word document, basics. And eventually, when I left the Air Force, where I was when I wrote it, I brought it to Baylor, and they loved it. They said, oh, can we give this to our medical students and our rotators and stuff? I said, yeah, that's what I wrote it for. A few years later, they said, would you revise it and update it? I said, okay. Every time I revised it, it got a little longer. I added some more details, some up-to-date stuff. Eventually, my wife said, you know, you ought to publish that. And during COVID,
when that's cool.
was going on, I did.
You self-published it?
Yeah. Yeah. I contacted some publishers, and they didn't think there was much of a market for it. So I said, okay, I'm going to publish it myself. And it worked well. So I got a book on for the perioperative nurses, a book for the medical students and residents. And then I updated the medical students book, and I'm in the process of updating and getting ready to release a second edition for the perioperative nurses book. But at the same time I was writing the deposition course, I had thought, you know, I really ought to write something about expert witnessing for doctors. Because a lot of the books that I read or that I read in preparation for the course and researching some stuff, they were either aimed at people giving depositions as a defendant or an expert witness who, not a doctor.
Maybe an engineer or something else.
Yeah. There's all, you know, as you know, there's all kinds of experts and seek caters to all kinds of experts and teaches all kinds of experts. but Amy's course online and Gretchen Green has a course too, are more focused on medical professionals. So I said, I ought to write a book about it. And so at the same time that I was creating the deposition course, I was creating the book.
Ta-da! Look at that guy. Awesome.
Put it on the screen.
And so it's called Expert Witnessing for Doctors. And yes. And when was that published?
2024, 2025. Let me see.
And that can be found on Amazon?
Yeah, 2025. It's on Amazon. Mm-hmm.
Awesome. And so tell me, so what are some of your high yield recommendations? Like, give me your top three things that you would tell somebody going into a deposition to make sure they do.
Okay. I found a lot of people had rules that they wrote up, and if I tried to include them all, they came down to 18. But I basically turned them into 6 rules for my course.
Okay. And I said, what are the 6 rules?
Yeah, the 6 rules. The first rule is listen carefully. That's what you have to do. When they're asking you a question, don't try to think about the answer, because then you're not listening anymore. Listen to the whole question. Okay, then the next rule, rule 2, is to pause, to consider. And that's what you do instead of thinking about an answer while they're asking the question. When it's done and you listen to the whole thing, then you stop for a minute and you think about, okay, what did the question really ask? Is there anything sneaky in there? And what do I need to say in the answer? Number 3, ask for clarification. If they ask a really long question, a compound question, or something that you just didn't understand, have them do it again or have them break it up or something. But ask for clarification if you need. Rule number 4, answer the question truthfully and concisely. Okay? Do not ever lie on the witness stand. You will be found out, and you will be crucified for it. But don't volunteer. The next rule, rule 5, volunteer nothing. So that's part of answering the question concisely. But in saying volunteer nothing, I put a little asterisk by it, because sometimes retaining counsel has said, hey, when opposing counsel asks you about this kind of thing or brings up that topic, that's where we have some real strength in our side of the case. So dive in and explain why that's important, why that's really good. So there's a few areas where sometimes you may not exactly follow volunteer nothing, but most doctors have a difficult time shutting up.
My wife is very true. I read a lot of depositions, and I think, yes. That is one of the biggest things that I see, is that people talk too much.
And my wife tells me she thinks that I'm in love with the sound of my own voice. So I'm no exception. But it's important. Volunteer nothing. Rule 6 is probably the most important of all. And it's called keep calm. Bunch of other rules in there that are kind of adjuncts and similar, but those 6 rules will get you really far in doing a good deposition.
Yeah, I think those are great. As somebody who's done a lot of depositions, I can fully agree that really is the foundation, and I tell people, you're not there to win the case. You're there to teach. It's not your job to win or lose the case. It's your job to be truthful. It's your job to teach. And it's your job to answer the questions. And it's the attorney's jobs to either win or lose the case. And you're but a piece of a puzzle that's creating a large picture. is the way I explain it to others.
I tell the students, well, educate, don't advocate.
That's a great, so John, you have a course out there. It's tied in with Amy, yeah, Amy Fogelman. And at the point that this, we did a two-part, we've previously done a two-part with Amy. And so people will be very aware. And, if they've listened to past episodes, they will know Amy well. And so this has been super helpful, John. I've really enjoyed getting a chance to talk with you today. I think our listeners are able to take away some real concrete advice from a veteran and a teacher and an expert's expert. So I want to thank you for joining me today, and telling us about your experience. So, thank you to Dr. John Lundell, for sharing his experiences and expertise with us today. I think the big takeaways really for today's playbook are those his path and how he got to where he is now, as well as those six takeaways. I hope if you liked this conversation and you feel John has more to say to you, you'll reach out and take his course, sign up for it and take his course and reach out to Amy Fogelman. And she has a broader course that goes even beyond depositions. So as always, I thank our listeners for tuning in. If you like this, please subscribe. And that helps get the word out. And thanks everybody for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Expert Witness Playbook.
Thank you. It was fun.
It was. See you, John.
Okay. Bye-bye.